Hey everybody, Vespi here. So you're going to get an extra bit of KingCast goodness this week. We have the author and professor Caroline Bix on, and you're going to hear our episode that would usually exist only behind the paywall over at Patreon, but it's a great episode. We wanted to give everybody a little taste of it, give her a chance to pimp out her great book, Monsters in the Archives, which can be picked up right now in a bookstore near you. And if you like what you hear, make sure to sign up for more over at patreon.com/thekingcast. You'll get access to all of our new bonus episodes as they come out that exist only behind that little paywall. And not only that, you're going to get access to our Discord and over 5 years of bonus episodes. So if you dig what you hear, make sure to sign up over at patreon.com/thekingcast for more like it. And yeah, without any further ado, let's get on with the chat, shall we?
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes dead is better.
This is the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
We are your hosts, as always, and today we have, Eric, we have a very, very cool guest today. I'm not even going to try to play it mellow, because I emailed you about her, and you were like, I'm already talking to her about her.
I'm already on it. I'm already on this.
I could not be more excited to have our guest, Caroline Bix, on the show. She has the best job title in the world, if you're somebody like Eric or myself. She is the Stephen E. King Chair in Literature at the University of Maine, Uncle Steve's alma mater, and she is the author of the fantastic new book, Monsters in the Archive, My Year of Fear with Stephen King, which does a forensic analysis of several of his best-loved books by comparing them with very early drafts. We see how Pet Sematary and the short stories of Night Shift and The Shining and Salem's Lot and Carrie all came together, evolved, and changed into what we know today, what we've loved for decades. The really interesting thing about this book is that Caroline's own story weaves its way into the narrative in ways that I was quite frankly very surprised by, but enjoyed very much. The cherry on top of it all is that Stephen King himself posted to social media, "This is the best book about my process that I have ever read." Congratulations on that, Caroline, but congrats on the book, too. I've really loved it, and I'm so happy to have you on the KingCast.
It is a pleasure to be here, so thank you.
I mentioned your own story becomes part of the narrative, and that really jumps out when you start talking about The Shining. And when I was young and I started reading Stephen King's books, I got about five or six deep before I wanted to know about the guy writing them. And Eric, I assume you were the same way. And one of the books I really loved was Bare Bones, if you ever read that, the collection of interviews with him. And I feel like now, all these years later, your book is doing the same thing. because I didn't read his books in chronological order. I kind of think I read them in the order you have them in the books, in your book, which is you start with Pet Sematary. That was my first. Yeah. Then The Shining, mm-hmm. Night Shift, Salem's Lot, and Carrie.
Yeah.
I wanted to begin with how you chose which books to look at.
Right. Well, I mean, so this project, so, you know, I'm an academic, I'm a Shakespearean. I came to this position as the Stephen E. King chair as a Shakespearean. The position had nothing to do with horror. It was just in, you know, honor of our most famous alum, Stephen King. So I did not think I'd be writing this book 5 years into my job. In fact, I was told by the university, do not make contact with him. You will never speak to him. I'm like, okay, fine. You know, it's a great job. I was happy to take the job. I had been at Boston College for 15 years before that on their faculty, teaching Shakespeare, tenured professor. But this was a great opportunity. It was endowed by the Harold Alphon Foundation, so it had this great fund for supporting the public humanities. So there were all kinds of awesome things about this job that made it worth it, even if I was never going to meet Stephen King. Although I was disappointed, but and it really wasn't.
It's weird. Yeah. It's weird that they would tell you that, right? Like, I can see, like, don't get up all in his grill, but like, but
don't
like,
make
don't.
Contact. Well, like, that seems like very careful. It's a very careful relationship, you know. It's a sensitive relationship between King and the university. Mm. And I, you know, I don't know if they were like waiting to see if I was going to be a crazy person. So they just wanted to, and I was happy to keep that boundary in place. You know, I'm a rule follower. As I talk about in the book, I was an anxious kid. I continue to be an anxious adult. Like I, this is why I'm a perfect profile to be an academic, you know?
Just as a little bit of background, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. You said you're a Shakespearean scholar. Assume you have a passion for all sorts of different literature from around the globe, from different time periods. Yeah. You did have a love of Stephen King, but you weren't given, you are not awarded the Stephen King chair in literature because you are a Stephen King scholar. You specialize in other things, right?
No, the department needed a Shakespearean. So that's, you know, that's my silo I was in. Like, I've written books about Shakespeare. That's my jam, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but of course, I loved Stephen King. I had been reading him since I was 12 when I picked up Night Shift. And it was interesting when you were talking about like which books you've read and in what order, you know, for me, I was a kid of the 70s. So I was reading all these books pretty much within a year or two of when they were coming out. It was pretty easy to catch up on the backlist of Stephen King in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So, you know, I started at 12 in 1979 with the paperback of Night Shift. Then I moved and read, you know, Carrie. Then I read Shining. Then I actually read The Stand. But it was like, this book I couldn't handle also dealing with The Stand because it's so big. But that one made a huge impact on me.
It's a rite of passage.
Yeah. And I think like it's been so fun talking to people about this book because as opposed to my academic books, which I love, but it's a much smaller, different audience, obviously. I love talking to people about their first experiences reading Stephen King. Mm. And a trend that I'm noticing is is that, you know, a lot of people were 12, 13 when they first started reading Stephen King.
And can I ask real quick, because one of the things we usually ask, and you've already got, you know, naturally got there, is what's your Stephen King origin story?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and, it was Night Shift, yeah.
And it's what's interesting to me is I found some commonalities that have popped up over, you know, hundreds of people have been on the show and been asked this question now, you know, famous people, not famous people, authors, actors, directors, you know, you name it. Some have never read a Stephen King thing, but they love a movie or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's always something, but there's still some commonalities I've noticed. And one of them you've already touched on, and that's King hooks you when you're young, right?
Hooks you when you're young.
And so I'm wondering if something has popped up in the questions you've been asking people here that I've noticed, and that is that for, I would say, 80% of the people we ask this question to, if they read King young, it almost always started with their mother. There's been a couple that it's like, oh, my dad had it. There's been a few that, like, you know, it was banned in this house, and I had to hide it, like it was a, you know, porno under a under a thing.
Oh my god! Which of course, interesting when I was doing the Night Shift research and reading the actual first drafts of, or the first printed versions of like Children of the Corn in the penthouse, you know, that they had in the archives. Right. Like, it brought back all these feelings of shame and like reading and like,
gotta flip past some interesting pictures to get to that story. Right. Yeah. But yeah. Have you noticed you know, I have a theory because of that, that, you know, that his early success was driven largely by a female audience that maybe didn't get credit.
Fascinating. I never have thought to study that, and I don't know how you would even know that, because it would just be anecdotal.
100%.
But it's
it feels right, though, right?
But that's a really interesting question, just thinking about the genre of, you know, the occult and horror as it was developing in the 70s, and so many of those occult stories were female-centric, you know, and thinking about, you know, The Exorcist and Audrey Rose, and certainly for me as a 12-year-old girl, you know, I was just sucking in all of those visuals, like on TV, like the TV versions. I wasn't reading Audrey Rose, but that had such a huge impact on me. And then, of course, Carrie being his first one. So I guess I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, if it were more of a female genre, just as sort of the early Gothic was geared toward female readers as well in the 18th century. I think that could be a really interesting theory that would play out if we could actually get that data.
Right.
For sure. But yeah, just in terms of, you know, going back to, because I feel like I want to finish the story how I actually got into the archives. I'm happy going down paths. Like this thing can go wherever, but I just want to make sure that people listening understand like that I didn't get this job because I'm a Stephen King, you know, specialist, and that it's not like Stephen King was like, hey, welcome to UMaine. Like it was 4 years into the job when I got a phone call at home from him, just a cold call. And I was like, whoa, you know, and that's when he said, I think we should meet. And so I invited him to come speak to our students at UMaine. It was a super secret visit because he didn't want anyone in upper admin or any media or what. So I was like, okay, I'll just organize this myself. I can tell my colleagues. The students were amazing. He was just phenomenally generous and came 2 days in a row. So that's when I met him for the first time, was him driving into the parking lot of my English department, which of course is the same building he had gone, you know, when he was an English major. And when he taught for a year in 1978, when he was living in that storied house on Route 15 in Orrington, where he imagined Pet Sematary, you know, he was a visiting professor at the University of Maine in 1978. So, you know, it was a really magical visit, and I felt comfortable enough with him that I felt I could ask him and Tabitha if I could go into their personal archives and spend my sabbatical year, because they had just collected all those materials and attached them to the back of that iconic house in Bangor, and they hadn't let anyone in there yet. And I thought, well, you know, enough trust had built up between me and, I don't know, Uncle Steve. I've never heard that, but anyway,
it's
Steve.
That's what he calls himself in all those little intros to the, to the short stories and all that. Like, your Uncle Steve can still scare you, you know.
Oh my God.
So.
Well, maybe it's, anyway. you know, they were very generous and said, okay, sure, you know, you can spend your year looking. And so I picked those five books because those are the ones that made the biggest impact on me when I was a teenager and were still sticking in my head, you know. And I was really intrigued as a literature scholar about how he crafted that so that they were still in my head. Like, I still remembered the last line of Pet Sematary. I still remembered the boogeyman, like the last line of the boogeyman. The boogeyman was a story that terrified me the most when I was 12, and it stuck with me. Like, I still can't sleep next to a open closet door. And, you know, so I just was really interested in figuring out the craft of it. Like, how did he do it? Like, if I could see the first draft and sort of track how he got there, what an incredible opportunity. A gift, and then that I could have conversations with him about. I can't talk to Shakespeare, you know, but hey, I can talk to him, you know. So it was just all in all a mind-blowing experience, as you can imagine.
I mentioned your personal experiences weave their way into the book, and I want to get into that a little more. Your expertise, but also just your approach to the world, your outlook on the world, your character. You become a character in this story. Mm-hmm. I love the notion of the diligent Shakespearean scholar who dives into the popular author's archive and comes away a little bit mad.
A little bit nuts. Yeah.
When you're like seeing all these connections in like the New York Times crossword puzzle and all that, and you're like, wait a minute, is this like taking over my life? It's a very John Carpenter-esque version of what you expect a literary scholar to be doing.
Yeah,
but I just want to backtrack to one thing, and I don't want to put you in a position where you have to break any of Steve's privacy, but you say he drives in, and I love a very funny section of the book is like you're preparing, like you get a parking pass, but then you've got to make sure there's a spot, like,
and it's anonymous. Go ahead.
This is exactly what I did, like, the first time I interviewed him. Like, I got so panicked and I had like three tape recorders going, but you say, he texts you or calls you, and he's like, don't worry, just hop in my car and we'll find a spot. What kind of car is Stephen King driving? I think the fans are going to be like, oh, he must drive. Like, the perception is he pulls in a 58 Plymouth Fury looking like Christine, or the Munster Mobile with like skulls and gargoyles.
It was totally this just totally bland sedan. Like, and this is like such a disappointment to my editor, David Ebershoff, who is unbelievable. Like, I'm so lucky I got to work with him. I remember he kept saying, "Can you describe the car? What color was it? What?" And I was like, "I don't remember." Like, I was in shock. I was really just focusing on getting him a parking spot.
I thought there was
and meeting him. And I so it wasn't anything remarkable because I obviously nothing stuck in my head. It wasn't like red. It was like literally could have been just a Toyota Camry or something like it, that. That's how bland it was. And
I figured he wouldn't have a car that has like a vinyl wrap on it that says, "Hey, I'm Stephen King. Ask me about my books."
No. I mean, he was wearing his son's baseball jacket that he likes to wear. You know, like that's his uniform. He enjoys that.
But I also thought maybe he would have a cool car. Like, you know,
it was seriously just the most average car. Like, honestly, and it's I'm sorry to my editor. I couldn't get any more I can't even remember the color. Like, that's how in shock I was that I was meeting him. Like, that's all I was focused on.
Yeah.
When you talk about the Shining, you actually answered a question I had for a long time. I knew about the prologue that he deleted called Before the Play.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's a weird thing to put as the title of a prologue. And you uncovered that he really structured this as a Shakespearean tragedy in five acts. And Jack Torrance mentions wanting to write a play in five acts.
Yeah.
Five acts is a lot. That's not the normally it's a three act structure in sort of modern plays.
Right.
But that you were determined to find out like what was his model for this? What was the Shakespearean play? And you thought it was Macbeth. And he eventually, I don't know that we want to say what the resolution to this mystery is, but I love that you brought that in. But also, you're a very soulful writer in that
you
talk about your going to the hotel, the Stanley Hotel, and not wanting to stay in the scary room because you've had experiences you can't explain.
Yes.
And I love that you brought this up because most scholars would be like, oh, I've got to be, you know, the scientific method.
It's been such a freeing process writing this book. And I knew from the start, well, first of all, when I went into the archives and spent a year in there, I didn't even know if this would be a book. I just wanted to see what was there because I had no idea. I didn't know what I'd find. So I just dove in. I would spend like 2 months per book just reading every single draft and tracking. And just, again, I didn't know what I was doing or what I was looking for. I just wanted to let each set of manuscripts tell me a different story and just let it come through. I didn't even plan which one I'd read in what order. Although I love that it turned out kind of organically to go from the most recent to the earliest, because that just allowed me to keep pulling back the layers, you know, seeing him, because day one, I'm in there with the Pet Sematary copy edited manuscript with the sticky notes with him talking to the copy editor. But that's 1982, you know, when he's already famous, you know, but it's, I could see him attending to word choice in such a specific way and being able to say, no, we're going to keep that. Whereas in 1974 when he's editing Carrie, he doesn't have that same freedom. Obviously, he has to do what Bill Thompson wants. So it's really interesting sort of starting when he's at his most established, actually, and working my way back. The Shining, what was so phenomenal about that one was going in and seeing this first draft, The Shine, which I know, and I'm sure you've had guests on here talking about that. I mean, maybe not, but I assume people have talked about this Shine manuscript. But the one that I saw is not one that other people have seen. Other people have ones called The Shine, but the way you know this is The Shine, the first Shine, is that her name is Jenny, not Wendy. And it is divided into acts and scenes, like Roman numeral acts and scenes. It is a Shakespearean tragedy, the way he's divided it up. And so that was a phenomenal discovery, just being able to see that was the organizing principle for him. And I had forgotten, because part of the process for me as well was going back, and I wanted to read the versions of the books I had read when I was a teenager. So I went on eBay, I went to local, you know, used bookstores, I went wherever I could to find them. It's actually not that hard to find books from the 70s that Stephen King wrote. But I wanted the exact same cover. I wanted the whole experience so I could recreate as best I could that embodied experience of reading him for the first time. You know, The Shining was definitely, that's the one that I still had from, that was the actual original one I had read in 1977.
So you, you create your theories about what, like, whether it's Macbeth or Hamlet, and then you get to, you do an interesting thing where then you ask him, like, is this right?
Right.
Is
I totally got off track there, by the way. I realized, I was like, right, you had asked me about the Shakespeare thing. Right. So because in the first draft of The Shine, what's really interesting is that there are buried things he edited out that are references to Macbeth. So I became convinced that this was a story about Macbeth, right? That this was, because there's so many elements of Macbeth that are in The Shining. You've got the brain-bashing Lady Macbeth and the brain-bashing father. You've got hallucinations. You've got all of the things that make Macbeth, Macbeth, right?
The woods coming to life, right?
You got the woods coming to life, right. So I thought, well, this must be the one. And I didn't want to ask him which one, because I really wanted to be like a literary detective and just see if I could let it tell me what it was. And then, you know, I did see a couple references as well to Ophelia that he had crossed out in the second draft that didn't make it into the final published one. So I was like, okay, I could see there's a Hamlet vibe here too, right? There are certainly references to Ophelia, the woman in the bathtub, a drowned girl. Like, I mean, I could feel a Hamlet vibe as well. But sure enough, when I finally asked him, it was like the pithiest, best short response in the history of short responses. He was like, yeah, it was Hamlet. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, we're done here.
And I love that you kept that in too, because it could have been just like, and obviously this is Hamlet from
the beginning. No, I mean, I didn't think it was obviously, it hadn't actually occurred to me. Even though I saw the Ophelia references, it really felt more like it was Macbeth, because there are just so many aspects to it that were Macbethian. But then as I got a chance to talk to him about The Shine and The Shining and the crazy alternative ending that's in The Shine that I got to talk to him about, I really came to appreciate how he pared it down and changed it to what we now know of as The Shining. You can see that he's working with the intergenerational trauma that is Macbeth, that is Hamlet. Sorry, it is Hamlet, right? I mean, that is a story about fathers and sons, and that the past is a ghost. So that when Jack's imagining the CB radio, like talking to him, the voice of his father coming through, of course, you know, that's so Hamlet. And Hamlet having to decide, am I going to follow the past of my father telling me I need to commit murder in his honor, right? Which is exactly what the voice is saying coming out of the CB radio, is like, or am I going to break the chain of violence, right? Because he's an abused kid himself, which comes out in that before the play that didn't make it to print. But you do get plenty of discussions in the book itself as it went to print that he was abused himself as a kid. So it becomes a much deeper, profound story.
When you speak to him, is it on email, or are you calling him and doing an interview, or how does it work?
It was a combination. I mean, most of the time through the year that I was doing it, it was email, because he's an incredibly fast emailer. Like, yes. I would send him a question and within an hour he would have this super profound, detailed answer to my question. I think part of the reason this relationship works and continues to work is that we meet each other at the level of the language. Like, we just both care so much about writing, and we care about teaching. I mean, that was what I realized the first day when he was talking to the students, and he was just incredible. You know, he's a teacher. And that comes through in everything from the way he's talking to the copy editor, like explaining to him why he wants to keep a certain word. You know, he's not being condescending. He's just like, let me just explain to you why this sounds better, right? You know, I would ask him very specific questions about word choice, or about, you know, or I would point something out. One of the fun things about this project, one of the many fun things, is that I could show him a manuscript page of his from 50 years ago and be like, hey, surprise, like, do you remember this note you wrote to yourself? And he'll be like, I mean, most of the time he actually did. He would be like, yeah, I actually do remember making that choice. And it was kind of fun for me to be like, this is your life. Ha! You know, like, how many people can show him his own writing and his own process, and, you know, get a chance to hear him talking about it and reflecting back on it, is such a privilege. And sometimes he wouldn't want to talk about it. You know, so it's also like a delicate relationship with Uncle Steve. You know, like, I couldn't be like, no, you need to talk to me about this now. You know, he might be like, I don't really actually want to talk about this, right? I mean, he wouldn't say that, but he just wouldn't reply. So, for example, with the Wizard of Oz change that I noticed in Pet Sematary, that there's no Oz the Great and Terrible in the first draft of Pet Sematary. And it's such an, you know, iconic motif in the published version. And I asked him, I was like, so what's up with the Wizard of Oz? Like, why did you change? Because Zelda originally has like a Raggedy Ann picture on her wall, not a Oz the Great and Terrible. And he just didn't answer, you know. So it wasn't until like a year later I circled back when I could have a face-to-face conversation with him and he couldn't run away. You know, I was like, okay, come on, let's talk about it. Tell me more about the Wizard of Oz.
And that's where he told you that just became the dominant motif. But he, so you got that after asking him and getting the cold shoulder?
Yeah, the dominant motif was what he gave me the first time. And I was like, why? Yeah, that was my follow-up question. I'm like, okay, yes, but why that one? And it was in our face-to-face when he told me more about Oz and what Oz means to him and how it connects to death and, you know, some pretty profound things. But our conversations really ran the gamut, you know.
As they do.
Yeah, as they do. And sometimes he'd want to tell me a personal story and sometimes, you know, I never asked him to reveal personal things. But if he wanted to tell me a story about growing up in Durham, Maine when he's 11, great. You know, that became a real heart for me of the Salem's Lot chapter, for example.
Well, I want to really point out, like, we've talked a bit about, you know, how the main focus here is showing the process, right? Showing, getting into the nuts and bolts between drafts and, you know, which has always been a very gray area with King. Like, mm-hmm. you hear about pads not taken, you hear about stuff, like, in bits and pieces, but to do a full-on examination with examples, you have photos of, mm-hmm. you know, of manuscript pages and notes to himself and strikeouts and all this stuff. So you have all that for us Stephen King nerds, but then, you know, as we've been talking about here, you get the color commentary by the guy himself. It's like having a director's commentary, right?
<That's true.
laughs> Here. And so, I mean, one of the things that I think is incredibly valuable about this is it goes beyond the academic of trying to assume what, you know, of drawing the lines yourself and connecting the dots. You said you can't talk to Shakespeare. You have to interpret his work and mm-hmm. and take guesses at what he was stabbing at a lot of the times and educated guesses, obviously, mm-hmm. and things that are supported by archival, manuscripts and all that stuff. But like here, you can actually go to the source and there's It feels like it's seeded so carefully throughout that you're always getting not just your interpretation of the stuff, you're getting your own personal relationship with the material, and then you're getting Steve's words themselves. And sometimes they can clash. You know, sometimes, like you said, sometimes Steve doesn't have the answers. Like Stephen Weber, who played Jack Torrance in the miniseries on and years and years ago. And, you know, he had a story about, you know, because King was there every day while they were making that thing. And mm-hmm. and he had made some sort of Stephen Weber was the kind of actor where he was like reading the book alongside the script and trying to draw the, you know, anything he could about his character. And he had some sort of backwards, like crazy, like, you know, mention about a pattern in a rug that, you know, maybe this is what, you know, and then this is referenced in this part. Mm-hmm. And then King, you know, like, he goes on this 5-minute thing to King himself. And King's just like, I probably just, you know, looked down at the rug and saw what pattern it was. You know, it wasn't any.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, he famously doesn't like to have his metaphors eviscerated,
right,
as he said to me. And that's, so again, that's always the delicate balance and was a real challenge for me as someone who, of course, like, I'm drawn to a metaphor like a moth to a flame. Like, I'm like, rah, rah, rah. Like, I have to stop myself from going too deeply, but at the same time, I want to. And that was actually a really kind of beautiful part of, like, also the dance we were doing, is that sometimes I would bring up something that I had found that seemed like an obvious influence. Like in the Night Shift chapter, when I went back and I read all of his college columns that he wrote for the UMaine campus newspaper, you know, and I read everything that was going on at the time in the paper when he's writing those columns, so I could get a real deep dive, because so many of those Night Shift stories he's writing when he's in college or right after. And, you know, so that was a case where I found all of this apparatus about, oh my gosh, there was a huge flu epidemic sweeping the world in 1969 when he writes Night Surf and publishes it in the UMaine Literary Magazine. And so when I, like, oh, I've discovered the origin story of The Stand, right? Because Night Surf is a precursor. And he's like, I don't think I was thinking about that when I wrote Night Surf. And I'm like, but then he said, But then he made this comment. He said, well, we were like those kids who went down to Fort Lauderdale during COVID. We just thought we'd live forever. Mm-hmm. And then that became like a gem for me to really think about, right? That's the cognitive dissonance of being 19, 20, right? You think you're going to live forever, but you also recognize the world's going to shit.
He's also talking about things from like 50, almost 60 years ago. Right. And sometimes what I find when I interview people about things they made even just a few decades ago, mm-hmm. they might have had an influence, but now they've forgotten it. And so they, mm-hmm. they tend to go, oh, no, no, it wasn't that. Like, and memories are faulty. And, so, yeah. and even Steve, when Eric and I have talked to him, and occasionally he's just like, I don't know. I just don't remember.
what mm-hmm. that was. And usually he's very good about saying, I don't remember.
Which is totally reasonable, because I've read things I've written not even that long ago. And, oh, yeah, I forgot all about that.
I don't remember what I did last week, y'all. Right. So this is, I get it. But
is there an enduring mystery about any of his books that you would love to solve, maybe in a future version? Like, I don't know if you have seat plans for follow-up books to this one that do similar things with another batch.
An enduring mystery. Yeah, I've never thought of it that way.
There's your title.
I have thought a lot, because I have been getting this question, like, are you going mm-hmm. hey, to go back in? Like, what else would you look at, you know? And I think I'd want to think hard about that, because this book was very special for me, because it really was an opportunity for me to go back into my childhood fears and my memories of reading King as a teenager. And I think part of what makes it a relatable book for people is that they can connect back to, right, I remember reading Salem's Lot. I remember the fear of someone scratching on my window, right? That it's, I can bring my literary scholar self, but also my scared teenager self and my terrified little four-year-old girl self to the table, right? So if I do another project like this, I want to make sure that I'm connected to it in a personal way. So, you know, I could see doing something. I mean, Enduring Mysteries, I would love to talk to him and like see what was going on in the early 90s when he writes that trio of very female-centered books that are fantastic. I mean, Dolores Claiborne, Gerald's Game, Rose Matters, you know, like what... Because that is my specialty in Shakespeare. I focus on women and girls in Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I could see that being really intriguing. I'd like to find out why that cluster then.
Yeah.
The one for me is, I just, you know, Richard Chismar does these books he does a lot of books that where writers analyze Steve's work. And
yeah, I'm going to be in the one on it.
Yeah, us too.
So I am too.
I think everyone's in that book. Like everyone I've talked to, they're like, I'm in there too.
Yeah.
So my question about that, I wrote about I did a couple of pieces that are in that, and one of them is about Charlie Howard, the gay man who was murdered in Bangor, Maine.
Yeah.
And the influence that had on Adrian Mellon, the character who's killed at the beginning of it. Now that murder happens in 1984. The book was, I think he says he began writing it in 1980, I think, or years before that, at least. It had obviously been near completion when Charlie Howard's murder happened. And I'm so curious, I would love to do what you did, which is go and look at early drafts of it and see what was there before he decided to take this real life incident that happened only a few blocks from that Victorian house that he has in Bangor. Like what happened before that to trigger Pennywise's return? But you did it with so beautifully with all of these other books, where we get to see the paths. The path's not taken, and you know, also, no, this is the wrong way to go, right? This is the wrong path. This leads off a cliff. Let's go another way.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's what's so fun. So I just taught The Shining last semester for the first time to so normally I teach Shakespeare classes, but obviously now I have a way into teaching classes on horror, and I taught The Shining for the first time to a group of undergrads, and he let them come to his house in Bangor, and he talked to them in his personal private library for an hour about The Shining, which was just extraordinary. And one of the things that he talked about was, because we talked about the alternative ending, which I don't want to give away, but he did say that, and this is something all King fans, I think, probably know this, is that he doesn't plot out his plots, mm-hmm. right? He lets the characters drive the story. But as he was talking about The Shining specifically, he said, I just really fell in love with Danny and Wendy. and I just couldn't keep my original ending. So it was really like that was a very powerful example of his craft, also meaning just how he intuitively lets characters lead him and how that's going to change the ending.
Can I take your classes? How do you enroll in this?
Well, you gotta come to Bangor, Maine, and Orono, and come. I don't do any online classes, but
no, I want to go in person to the library and talk to Uncle Steve. I mean,
that was a super special day for sure because he'd never had students in there, and it was just they were so obviously excited. A lot of them are Maine kids themselves who want to be creative writers, and they don't get a lot of exposure to famous people in Orono, Maine.
Felt a part of my affection for your book is, I don't know if the right term for this would be confirmation bias, but you, right in the very first section, you talk about Pet Sematary. And when I, like, again, Richard Chismar did this book, My Scariest Stephen King Scene.
Okay.
And a bunch of writers wrote about, you know, which scene from his books they thought was the most terrifying and most unsettling, and they explain why. I chose the unburial of Gage Creed, which you describe as his most disturbing passage. That's, so I felt like, yes, the Stephen E. King chair is validating my belief.
And Uncle Steve himself has said that's the one that made him put the book away. I mean, like, that's the scene that was so horrifying he didn't want to publish that book. And just seeing how he changed it and revised it to make it even more horrible. So you must have enjoyed that part. I mean, seeing like how it starts, it's like the first draft, it's like kind of easy digging up Creed, you know, I'm sorry, digging up Gage. Mm-hmm. Cause there's no concrete grave liner. And that's what he writes to himself on the margin is like, if you added a concrete grave liner, you know, so you can see him think as like, he made it so much harder for Lewis to do it, which means he had so much more time to think about this horrible step he was taking.
And your comparison, too, validated something that I noticed, but I didn't have the data to back it up that you provide, which is in the early parts of the book, before he gets to the unburial, he really spares the reader the gruesomeness of Gage's accident. You know, we get flashes of what happened. There's abstraction, the shoe, the hat. The fact that he's dead before there's anything we can do about it. Like, he has that passage about what the human mind can endure. And then it's like, that was Saturday. That was 3 days ago. He's dead before we can react. We don't see it happen. And then he describes it a little and you have the one sort of, it sounds like there's no punctuation in the way he describes what happened.
It's literally the longest sentence, although now that the Pulitzer has been won by one sentence novel just yesterday. But anyway, it's like this long run-on sentence that captures that horror. Yeah, go ahead.
But he spares the reader the gruesomeness until he gets to the unburial, and then he does not let us off the hook. And I feel like if he had been grossing us out the whole time or shocking us with Gage's physicality and the brutality of an accident on a 3-year-old's body, we would have been inured to it by the time he got to the unburial. But what makes that unburial so gruesome is even Lewis, everybody else has been pushing the reality away. But then when he makes this choice to resist nature and the way things are and dig up the boy
and face the horror of it,
he's confronted with the mold and the smell and the sounds. You do such a beautiful job describing the way the sound gets into your blood as you read this story.
And that's what really came forward for me reading all of the Pet Sematary drafts, is he's pulling out word sounds in much more intentional ways as he goes, as he drafts, you know. And actually that in that first draft of Pet Sematary, there is much more of a gruesome description of Gage's body when he has the accident. Yeah. You know,
That's what's interesting.
Right.
He knew to cut.
And same thing he does with Salem's Lot with the drafts is like baby Randy in the first draft of Salem's Lot called Second Coming. You know, you see baby Randy vampire getting staked. You see his body like exploding. I mean, like it's horrific. And that's one of my favorite margin notes I found was that in the margin he's written a little too much. but then he writes, but how to change? I'm like, okay, I think the answer was a good one. Take it out, which he did.
Do I dare remove the exploding vampire baby?
Do I dare remove an exploding vampire baby? Yes, he did. So yeah, but, and that was an interesting case. So the Gage thing, because I was haunted by the movie Pet Sematary, which I'm not a huge fan of, but you know, it was filmed right around here. And I do remember like that was a very horrifying scene, obviously, when Gage gets hit. And I don't know if you remember this. I'm sure you've seen the Pet Sematary film. Like there's a sneaker that lands in the middle of the road and it's filled with blood. I saw that in the very first draft, but it didn't make it into the written, into the published version. And I was like, oh, that was lingering. That was an image lingering in King's own head because he wrote the screenplay for Pet Sematary. And I was like, because I was like, God, I remember something about a, why aren't I seeing it? Because when the night before when I had reread the actual published version, I was like, where's the sneaker? I remember it from the film. And I was like, it's not there, but there it is in the original one. You know, and I was like, I felt like just as he has the boogeyman be in the closet instead of Zelda in the first draft of Pet Sematary. Yeah. So I was like, oh my God, there's my personal monster is actually, it's like a secret showing just for me in the first draft of the Shining of Pet Sematary. Thanks, Steve. Thanks well, for putting that in my head.
That sneaker image has become talismanic for King too, because whenever he references Pet Sematary in other books, it's always Gage's sneaker, whether it's in the bald doctor's lair or whatever in Insomnia. I think it popped up in a recent thing, didn't it, Brez?
It's in King's Sorrow.
Joe Hill mentions,
I think he mentions the sneaker, too. Or maybe it's the ball cap. I can't
remember. Right.
Oh, well, the ball cap, that one makes it through. But something you said, I was thinking about how what's so brilliant, he's so good at so many things. But one of the things that I think the reason the stories endure and I started to appreciate more is because as he's recrafting, he understands how the brain manages trauma. Right? He understands that it's going to come in flashes. It's going to come in dreams. It's going to come in pieces. It's not going to come as a narrative start to finish. And I think whether he did it intentionally or not, or intuitively just understood that if you're going to craft a traumatic episode, it's going to come in flashes. It's not going to come as that unspooled, unbroken narrative. And I could see him as he was redrafting, really leaning into that.
For sure. One thing that I want to talk about when it comes to Pet Sematary is something that I noticed at least through Pet Sematary and The Shining was the things that were jumping out to me in the revision process was a kind of pulling back. And this is something we were talking a little bit off mic about, where the Gage that appears in the original drafts is more of an EC Comics, you know, it's
pure
a
evil.
Evil, malevolent, you know, being, it's almost more Reagan in The Exorcist kind of thing. There's a being inside this boy's body.
Yeah.
And I think he, in a weird way, he makes it more complex and in a weird way makes him scaling back the evilness of this child, the laughing as he's grabbing the scalpel out of the bag and all that stuff. That seems like that would be the scarier version, but it is way more messed up and way more interesting when there's little bits of who Gage was,
this little boy Gage still there, mixed
with the evil, and it becomes something way more complex and something that none of the adaptations have really gotten to grapple with in the cinematic version.
That was probably there were so many changes that really hit me in the gut, and I would say that one I appreciated so much more that Rachel, you know, she sees her little boy running toward her and she actually thinks it's her little boy, you know, the way he recrafts it. But in the first version, she actually thinks it's Zelda, you know, has taken over her little boy and it's just an evil spirit. And so and you see the scalpel, like he describes, the scalpel made a singing sound in the hall, you know, so that's the first version. She knows that it's not her little boy and she knows it's an evil spirit. But in that second version, when he finally gets to the final version, it's like, oh, he captures that horrible love, right? That like, oh, like she loves him so much. She's so happy to see him that I don't think she knows that he's about to kill her at all. You know, she just thinks she's seen her little boy. And that does make it all the more horrible because it gets at, like we were talking about before, like that horrible decision that Lewis has to make, like, is this worth it? How much do I love somebody that I'm willing to do this?
You know, I'm so glad you studied this book so intently at the beginning of your book, because I think Pet Sematary is such a deep novel. I love it so much, not just because it's a scary book. I think it's really about loss and the unimaginable and things that people do have to face, even though none of us want to deal with it. When I wrote about it in this scariest scene book, I said, it's like a prayer, like, please don't let this happen to
please don't let it happen. And that's, that's what I came away with after doing all this work, was realizing, right, it's not about the monsters. He crafts really terrifying monsters, but what makes the stories stick with you is that they connect to these very real fears we have about loss and grief. Or even, I was listening to your recent interview, and I apologize, I can't remember who it was, who was talking about The Woman in the Room, which was a real surprise for me. That's one of the ones that I was able to find an early draft of in the archives. When I was 12 and reading Night Shift, I didn't even pay attention to The Woman in the Room. I'm like, well, that's not scary, whatever. That's just, you know, like when you're 12. But now I'm like, wow. Why did he make that one the last story in Night Shift, you know, which is not supernatural, which is based on his mother's own death.
Yeah.
And it really gave me this way, and seeing the first draft, which is so, and that's one of the four that he never sold before he put it into Night Shift. There are only four out of the 20. That's one of the, he didn't sell that one. He wrote it right after his mother's death. He did not try to sell it. It served a different purpose for him. And the first draft that's in the archive, it's called The Last of Her. And then he crosses it out, and then he calls it Time in a Glass That Ran, he writes. So it's like he's working out, like, what is this? What does this mean? What is this story, right? And
I kind of like The Last of Her, though. I like
The Last of Her, yeah, is great. Yeah, but you can see him working through, like, that was one of the privileges, one of the many privileges of being in the archives, seeing, like, what was he thinking? Why that first version of a title? And what got him to The Woman in the Room, you know? And that version that's in the archives, it has a very different backstory. You get a lot more backstory about the mom that is so much more, that is very connected to King's own mom, you know?
Yeah.
Has many more details. And I guess it just got me thinking about the purpose of a horror story, right? It's not necessarily to launch you into some supernatural realm. It's to help you metabolize grief.
The tragedy of his mother, too, is that she was such a hardworking woman and raised her two sons. The saddest story I know is that she used to send him money for college, like spending money, and she found out after she died that she would skip a meal so he and his brother could get like $5 in the mail every week. And that she died really before he achieved the means to give her comfort, you know?
Last couple of months he was able to, right? He gets that $400,000 windfall. Yeah. And then he's able to have her stop working, right, at Pine Lake Center. But, I mean, it's like she's almost dead at that point.
He says she was, like, bombed out of her mind on painkillers, working at an insane asylum. Like, it's, like, the worst job in the world and most grueling job. But, yeah, he is able to give her the last few months, but nothing else. He never gets to do the Elvis Presley, like, I'm going to buy you a car and I'm going to buy you a house and I'm going to buy you.
At least she knew that he sold Carrie.
Yeah, but it's such a story, still, a beautiful story of mothers and parents sacrificing for their kids. She never gets the reward as much.
Well,
you know?
I mean, I guess the reward is she launched this incredible writer. Yeah. I mean, like, she's the one going to the public library and getting out Bram Stoker for him when he's nine. You know, I mean, like, she's, you know.
And in your book, I think he mentions Lewis Creed's aunt comes into play at one point, which I think was cut from the final version. And her name is Ruthie, right?
So it's actually his cousin. So this is actually interesting. Yeah, that was another weird. I was like, oh, because in the first draft, it's actually his mother who has died, you know, when he has this memory about his first memory of death, and his father is alive still. And his father's just delivering this like cold, hard truth. Like, yeah, she's dead. She's dead. Dead is dead. I'm like, Jesus. Okay, Dad. And it's his first memory of it. And then in the revised version, he has a memory of his mother telling him about his cousin Ruthie, right, who's died. And his mom is much more empathetic delivering the news. Like, I know, honey, it's so hard. I know. I'm so sorry. You know, and it's like, right, it's all about moms being, back to the question of moms being how we first get Stephen King. Maybe moms are also our first associations with metabolizing hard things like that, if you're very lucky to have a mother who would sit with you while you're experiencing your first experience of grief, which King was, like, when he talks about, you know, that story, which is in Grandma, the story, like, he actually did find his grandmother dead when he was 15. And he, you know, his mother was there to help him through that, which is a story that's also part of The Woman in the
Room. Wow. Well, do you have any artifacts of your own? You mentioned having books, wanting to reconnect with the same kind of paperbacks you had. I noticed your novel, or your book, the book cover looks like a beaten up Stephen King paperback. Well, she's getting up. This is good podcasting. She's gotten up and walked to a shelf.
So this is the actual Shining.
Oh, it's a yellow paperback with the Kubrick movie version.
It's the Kubrick that has the inserts from the Kubrick film. So this was the one that I took off my sister's shelf. And I think for a lot of us who read them too young, it was because we had older siblings, you know, not just moms.
Right.
This is my artifact. This is my first. I also have the Wizard of Oz book that I read when I was, you know, I opened the book talking about how the Wizard of Oz helped me metabolize my fears as a 5-year-old, you know, sitting with my mom. So my earliest memories of reading and understanding fear and catharsis through book is through my mother, who sat with me while I read this out loud to her.
My favorite artifact of Stephen King, I have a couple of like things that are actually valuable. Like I have one of the Startling Mystery Stories from his first published short story, The Glass Floor.
Yes. That's fantastic.
Is it The Glass Floor?
I think it's The Glass Floor.
But the thing, if the wildfires ever come from my house, the thing I'll grab first is my paperback of Pet Sematary that my grandmother and grandfather bought for me so that they wouldn't have to take me to the movie.
On the cover? Was it church?
It's the cat. It's that typical, it's that one from, it's the same hardback cover of the screaming face that Linda Fenimore drew, the shrieking cat, which she drew from a lion because she said she went to the New York Public Library to get examples of screeching cats, and people don't take photographs of screeching cats. Like now you can find anything online now, but she goes, when you had to research something, you go through pictures of cats and they're all like hang in there or looking cute and cuddly. Nobody takes an angry cat picture. So she had to model that shrieking church on like a panther or a lion that was roaring.
Oh my God.
You know, that mouth.
Such a scary.
But I think what's interesting is your book looks like a tattered Stephen King paperback.
It's a beautiful cover. I love it.
It is, but I think there's something in that people, the affection that people feel for Stephen King's stories is not the same as they feel toward authors who are maybe more critically celebrated, you know, where you have like a pristine first edition. Certainly people collect their first pristine first editions of Steve's books. But you talk to most fans, and the book they're going to treasure looks like your cover with the scratches, the broken spine, you know. Can you tell me about that, about the relationship people have with the physical books of his and how that differs from maybe other authors?
Well, I mean, so part of, you know, at the core of this book, like my passion for what I do, and I've been teaching literature for 35 years now, right? Obviously, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't feel passionately about the power of books and actually like physical books, you know, and I dedicate this book to librarians and to teachers because they're the ones holding on tight, and especially, and I didn't even, just even in the last 8 months, I mean, teaching in the age of AI is, it's a fucking disaster. Like it's not, this is not going well. You know, anyone who teaches, at least in a humanities classroom, understands that all we're doing is detaching kids from their humanity when we're doing this, you know. So I didn't appreciate that was going to happen when I started this book, but I feel even more passionately now. You know, in my classrooms, we are holding the books. They're getting the hard copies, unless they have an accommodation that they need a screen, which I totally get. You know, students are buying the books. I'll tell you what, like our university bookstore, unfortunately, like there are only like 6 of us who actually order books, like professors, you know, like hard copies of books. Like it's just, it's disappearing. And that makes me enormously sad for so many reasons. But one of them is very much what you're just pointing to here, which is that people have memories of holding the book, right? Remember, like, I remember reading The Stand, you know, and feeling like it's so heavy. I feel so important and grown up. I remember like my arm falling asleep as I'm trying to prop open the book, you know, and read it, you know, and I feel like, what are we losing when we stop having an embodied experience of reading that is really taking in our full selves, you know? Mm-hmm. Horror comes from that Latin root horrere, which is to bristle, right? Your hair is standing on end. Like, mm-hmm. we're losing touch with our embodied human reactions to all of our emotions. And another thing that's come out for me as I've been talking to people about this book, you know, is that fear and horror, it's something that helps us wake up. Like, we've been so siloed off and numbed from our emotions for the past, you know, take your pick. I'm going to say 10 years, but, you know, certainly things have, in America, things have been getting worse and worse and worse, and people aren't feeling things, or we have to cut off to survive, right? I feel like what's kind of oddly optimistic about horror is that it helps us feel things. And if we've all experienced the same stories together, there's a community aspect to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about the origin of horror stories. It's people sitting around fires and telling stories together. It's a way for groups to metabolize things together. So this is a little bit off from what you were asking originally, mm-hmm. but to me, it's like, yeah, we can all talk about, yeah, that picture of the cat. You know, we can all have these memories that are sparked, yes, by the words. And that's what this book is. It's a love letter to language, you know. But it's also about books as material objects.
It helps root a memory in a way that, like, mm-hmm. you know, reading something on a Kindle or, you know, like, unfortunately with your book, I don't have a physical copy. I was reading it on an iPad as I was traveling, you know, but and that doesn't take the value away from the words, but I think it would probably take the value away from my memory of it. Like you said, like, I have those, you know, memories of of being the dumb kid holding nightmares and dreamscapes. You know, I was in bed reading it over a summer, I remember, and I was holding it up and I slipped and the goddamn thing fell on my face and it hurt. And it hurt, right?
You're going to remember that book.
Yeah, I'm going to remember. It probably left me a physical scar. No, it didn't. It didn't. It wasn't that bad. But, you
Steve,
know,
Steve is somewhere like, take that, kid. Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I remember it was during the finger story, the moving finger.
Oh, God.
Like, in, so that's, you know, that's something that happened 35 years ago now, maybe.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
30 years ago, you know, and I'll always have that memory. Whereas, you know, I'm not going to really remember, you know, listening to, you know, you Like It Darker on an audiobook for the first time. You know, I might remember the narration, you know, I might remember, you know, a feeling I had around it. But, you know, there is that tangible physical thing that happens where the feel of the cover, and I'll usually took them off and always found like the little foil stamp Stephen King signature or the SK or whatever in there and feeling like, oh, I found an Easter egg, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like there's something to that tangible thing that I think helps solidify, you know, a moment in time in a way that digital age kind of prevents. Yeah.
Did you get him to autograph your copy of The Shining?
I did not. I didn't think to do that. So, but what I was going to say, another artifact that I really treasure was the day he came to talk to the students. So the day I met him, and I had my copy of On Writing, my original 2000 copy, and I just brought it with me and had just left it on a table, you know, and he surreptitiously signed it and wrote, thanks for having me, and dated it and signed it. And I'm like, I found it later. I was like, oh my God, I got like, he just surprised me with that, you know? And it was amazing. Like, and he did it totally like under the radar. That's how he likes to operate. You know, he doesn't want to be. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, go ahead.
Well, the reason I ask is like, if I were to get, I've interviewed him probably 20 some times, but I've never met him in person. And if I could get one thing autographed, it wouldn't be the first editions that I have or anything like that. It would just be that first book that's all beaten up, because that's the one that means the most. That's the one that started my journey with him. And it wouldn't have any value to anybody except to me that I got the author's signature on this artifact that means so much. I have it under glass now. It's this beat up. It's a paperback you wouldn't even buy at a used bookstore, because they would be like, this is too beaten up. We'll throw it away. Like,
oh my gosh, amazing.
But to me, it's like one of my most treasured possessions.
Yeah. I mean, I will say now, because I'm obviously not totally anti-technology, you know, since a lot of my conversations with him were over email, I'm just so happy I have this now archived collection of conversations with him that are emails, you know, where he'll just reveal these gems, and I've got them, like, you know, so I won't lose those.
Well, I'm pretty sure King is, you know, he solidified his place now, but, you know, I think he's also proven that he's going to last well beyond us, well beyond him. And I think your book is going to be an invaluable glimpse into his process, not just through the papers, as I said, but being able to have the color commentary from the man himself.
Yeah.
You know, I would be very shocked if, you know, if we could look forward, you know, 100 years from now, that your book isn't going to be something that, becomes a, you know, kind of a necessary, way to unlock, you know, King and King's mind. And I think you provided a very valuable thing for not just us current nerds, but for, you know, the many generations of King fans to come.
Yeah. Wow. Eric and I know all sorts of stuff about him, and I still found all sorts of revealing and surprising things in your book. And so I'm really glad it exists and grateful to you for taking the time.
Including
to
that Shining ending, which we're going to keep super secret.
Oh, God.
You have to read it. And
I kind of feel badly unleashing that on the world.
We can't share that.
It's hard to unsee it once you see it. It's like,
we can't share that on the King Cast because this is a family show.
Right. Well, thank you for those kind words. I appreciate it. And
before we let you go, I have an academic question for you.
Okay.
So you are the Stephen E. King Chair of Literature at the University of Maine. Is there a Dean R. Koontz Chair of Literature? And do you feel any kind of intense 1980s era rivalry with this person?
No.
No. Well, that is the perfect answer. Is there a Dean R. Koontz Chair somewhere? No!
I mean,
that
like
is the correct answer.
Nobody has a cooler job title than me. Like, it just seems like it's not even a competition.
Yeah.
I figured. Yeah, sorry. I mean, do you know if there is one? I don't even know.
I should Google that before I ask.
We could Google it right now. Maybe we'll have, like, it'll be like some reality show, like, you know, like The Traitors, but it's like bring together all of the name chairs of famous people,
yes.
And like we all have to try to, you know, outwit
the V.C. Andrews Chair of Incest Literature.
I would love to be the V.C. Andrews Chair. God.
Of weird incest in books, yes.
Yeah.
The John Saul Movie of the Week version of Stephen King Chair of Literature.
Fantastic.
So where can people find the book? It's out now. Where would you prefer people? As we just had this conversation about physical copies and ordering books and doing the old school way. What would you recommend?
Well, I would say go to your local independent bookseller. And if you don't have a local independent bookseller, then go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. But it is available everywhere you get your books. And you can also learn more about my book events at carolinebix.com.
Do you have anything exciting coming up? This is probably going to hit on Friday.
So next Tuesday, I'm going to be in Los Angeles at Book Soup, if anyone's in LA.
Yeah.
And then over the summer,
Brez's eyes lit up. He's like, I'm going to get my copy signed.
Come to Book Soup, May 12th. Yeah. And then I've got a bunch of Maine events over the summer. College of the Atlantic and here at Blue Hill at the Blue Hill Public Library and Barnswallow Books in Rockport. So, yeah, lots of events coming up.
All right. Everybody check out this book. It's crack for King fans, and it is so good. It is dense, but not like tough to get through. It's such an easy read. I'm very excited to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Been a blast.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.